From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, we'll get some insights into the Wisconsin redistricting case in front of the Supreme Court this week.
Later, astronaut Kathy Sullivan describes the unique feeling of walking in space.
It's a fabulously free feeling of movement. And of course, quite a coveted and very special experience to be looking at the Earth sliding by beneath you with, you know, no window frame. It's really, you know, you looking at the Earth.
How WUWM's beat reporters are getting story ideas from listeners.
And why cellist Robert Cohen has switched from paper sheet music to an iPad when he performs.
I'm reliant on good light. And there are so many occasions on stage even where the light isn't that great and not specifically for reading music.
Lake Effect next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Tomorrow, the Supreme Court of the United States will hear oral arguments on Gill versus Whitford, also known as the Wisconsin gerrymandering case.
There is a lot of uncertainty as to how the court will rule, with most of the conservative and liberal justices coming down on opposite sides of the issue. As is often the case, Justice Kennedy will likely be the deciding vote.
Writer David Daley is the author of Rat Effed, which takes an in-depth look at the GOP Red Map project and the 2010 nationwide redistricting, which left a majority of state legislatures in Republican hands despite earning fewer votes than Democrats. Daley spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers about Gill v. Whitford and what it could mean for the future of democracy.
Well, Gill versus Whitford really is the most important Supreme Court case having to do with our democracy since the Citizens United case nearly a decade ago. This is an opportunity for the Supreme Court of the United States to put an end to one of the most toxic things in our democracy, partisan gerrymandering. It all starts from a case there in Wisconsin having to do with the lines that the Republican state legislature drew following the 2010 census there in Wisconsin. Those lines, which were drawn behind closed doors in 2011, were drawn, the courts have said time and again, to really maximize partisan impact for the Republican Party. In 2012, the first election that were run on those lines, Democrats got more votes for the Wisconsin State Assembly. Republicans, however, took 60 of the 99 seats. So if all the votes go one way and all the seats go the other, you can certainly have a sense that those were very, very powerful district lines.
They weren't shy about what they were doing with the redistricting. They were very clear that it was partisan gerrymandering. But really, currently, that's not illegal in any way.
That is why this case is so important. The Supreme Court has always said that it's up to lawmakers to draw political lines, that this is an inherently a political activity. So never in the history of the country has the court stepped in at this level and said partisan gerrymandering itself is unconstitutional. And really what has changed is that the ability to draw these lines in an unbeatable fashion has really, really become much more commonplace due to big data, due to powerful computers, due to a software that allow you really to surgically craft these lines. So the map makers now have got more information on us. We're more partisan and polarized, so we are easily drawn into districts because our voting patterns are so predictable. And it's the data, the technology, and the ease and the certainty with which it can be manipulated now that makes the post-2010 redistricting cycle so fundamentally different from any other in our time. And it's why the courts need to step in now and try to find a solution to this.
Now, the Supreme Court actually heard arguments on partisan gerrymandering about 13 years ago in a case called, I'm going to butcher this, but Jabilare?
Yes, indeed. That is tough. It's a tough name for somebody who occasionally stutters. Jubilerer, right?
Yeah. So what was that case?
That is a fascinating case. That is the last time that the Supreme Court took up partisan gerrymandering. It's a case out of Pennsylvania in which voters in Pennsylvania sued, saying that their constitutional right to equal protection under the law had been abused by the lines that were drawn for Pennsylvania's congressional districts after the 2000 census. And what you had was a very divided court. You had four conservative justices who were ready to say that partisan gerrymandering is simply part of the political thicket and it should be considered non-justiciable. They were ready to close the door on future claims. You had four liberal justices who said, this is a serious problem and we have to do something about it. And they were ready to step in and try to find a remedy. And then you had Justice Kennedy in the middle, as he is now. And Kennedy writes a really interesting concurrence. He ends up siding with the conservatives because he does not see a clear and manageable standard by which to define partisan gerrymandering in that case. He didn't see a way to resolve it that was clear, reliable, and able to be applied across states and across different situations. And he writes a concurrence with the conservatives, but it's his own concurrence. And what he says is, I'm not willing to close the door on this. This is an important issue, and technology is getting very serious here. And just because I don't see a standard in this case doesn't mean someone won't show me a standard down the line. And that really sets off all kinds of law professors and stats geeks and gerrymandering nerds looking for that kind of holy grail democracy theorem that might please Justice Kennedy. And what this really leads to is a standard called the efficiency gap, which has been at the heart of Gill versus Whitford, and it is one of the ways in which you can show when a partisan gerrymander has crossed a line and gone too far.
So the efficiency gap is really how Gill v. Whitford is responding to the previous partisan gerrymandering case. And while the actors in the Supreme Court are obviously a bit different, we're still in a similar situation where we have four or five, by some estimates, conservative judges. We have four or again, five more liberal justices. Do we know how that's going to impact this case?
A couple of the faces have changed, but the basic lineup is still the same. You've got four conservatives who seem ready again to call this non-justiciable. You have the four liberals. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, in an interview the other night in New York with Charlie Rose, talked again about how important this case is and finding a standard is and ending partisan gerrymandering is. So they clearly remain very interested, and it's all eyes on Justice Kennedy. Once again, he is the swing vote. He's a swing vote at a time in which there are lots of rumors swirling about that this could be his last year on the court. So this, in many ways, could be the last chance for a meaningful standard on this. So much depends on whether Kennedy sees something in the efficiency gap and in the other social science standards that are being brought to him in the briefs on this case. If it does, this has the potential on the verge of the 2020 census and the 2021 redistricting cycle to dramatically upend our politics. We are a deeply and closely divided country in which all of the political power essentially rests with the Republicans, not only all of Washington, but 69 of 99 state legislative chambers, 34 governorships. And it's the governors and the state legislatures that play the key role in drawing these lines. So as we head into the 2020 and 2021 cycle, Republicans are still going to have a dramatic edge when it comes to drawing these lines. The computers and the data have only gotten better. If Justice Kennedy does not see a standard here to help rein in this kind of extreme partisan behavior, maps like this and divisive politics like this will continue for another decade, and it will be 2031 until Democrats get another shot at these maps.
And this is despite the fact that in many of these states, Democrats are actually receiving more votes.
Yes, and that is what I think that the courts are really struck by. It seems to me that a situation like Wisconsin or North Carolina or Michigan, Ohio, you are seeing right now just how enduring and durable these lines are. So the lines that were drawn in 2011 to really maximize partisan advantage have been so effective that in a state like Michigan, Democrats have gotten more votes in 2012, 2014, and 2016 for their state house. Republicans have held the chamber in all of those years. Wisconsin, where this case started, you had Democrats get many, many more votes in 2012, but only 60 of 99 seats. And what's happened in Wisconsin since then is that these districts are so lopsided and uncompetitive that now you simply can't find a candidate in these races. In 49% of Wisconsin's assembly races in 2016, there was no major party competition. So, I mean, it's almost unfair to add up the total number of votes there. But in half of these races, voters don't have any choice at all. And that's how corrosive gerrymandering is to a democracy. It creates districts that are uncompetitive. It insulates our politicians from the ballot box. It makes them responsive only to the most extreme wings of their own party, because when you don't have to worry about losing a general election, all you have to do is concern yourself with fending off a primary challenge from someone more extreme in your own party, and it leads to the kind of dysfunctional and unresponsive and non-representative government that we're seeing at all levels in our politics today.
Now, a bipartisan group of politicians filed an amicus brief opposing partisan gerrymandering. Could that have an impact on the court's decision on the more conservative justices?
I think it is a terrific sign that this is becoming a bipartisan issue. It needs to be. This is really an issue that's about a democracy. This is not an issue that ought to be considered through our red glasses or our blue glasses, even though it seems like that's how we look at everything these days. But you have a growing number of folks in the general public. There was a poll taken on this earlier this month that showed upwards of 70% of all voters were so concerned about this that they said that they would like to see a standard on this, even if it harmed their own side, because it was that important for the integrity of our elections to have the side with the most votes actually winning. I think that what you saw in that amicus brief was that it was largely former Republican politicians who were signing on to this. It was Bob Dole, it was Arnold Schwarzenegger, Richard Lugar, Jim Edgar, you know, lots of names from the 90s and the O's. I believe the biggest current Republican who was on that was Ohio Governor John Kasich, who has become very outspoken about this. I think that one of the effects of partisan gerrymandering has been that it's taken the Republican Party and it's pushed them further right in states and in Congress, and that it may well take establishment moderate conservatives like Kasich taking a look at sort of what the unintended consequences of this kind of aggressive, extreme redistricting have been to their own party to sort of help pull it back towards the middle again, which would be a terrific thing for, I think, all Americans.
So what can we expect to happen on October 3rd?
It's a great question. I mean, it will be all eyes on Justice Kennedy. I think people will be really curious to see how Kennedy approaches his questioning on the efficiency gap. This is not something that is universally believed to be, a silver bullet, a democracy cure. There are some critics who say that this is just an old-fashioned seat-to-vote ratio, and it's the kind of thing that Kennedy and other justices have thrown out in the past as not being clear enough, not being easily transferable across states. So I think the important thing will be to watch how Kennedy responds to the efficiency gap. And then the second thing will be to watch how Kennedy and the other justices, especially any of the conservative ones, if they're concerned about the way that redistricting has changed this decade. Again, it's been 12 or 13 years since this has come before them. Redistricting has gotten more durable. Since then, the number of swing seats in Congress and in state legislatures keeps declining. The numbers of states in which Republicans hold supermajorities, even though they get fewer votes, has grown dramatically. And it will be interesting to see if any of the justices on the right side of this are concerned about that, and not from a political perspective, but from a sense of the health of a democracy.
When will we know their decision?
With all likelihood, not until June of next year.
So no decisions probably before the 2018 election.
This would probably come down in June of 2018, but it becomes a real question of kind of what kind of remedy the courts will order. Courts don't usually like forcing new maps to be drawn that close to an election. And indeed, the lower court, as part of their finding that these districts were unconstitutional in Wisconsin, they ordered new maps. When the Supreme Court agreed to hear this case back in the spring, they stayed and put a temporary halt to the drawing of those new maps. So that process in Wisconsin has stopped. If the courts renew that, it would be June or July of next year, and then you're certainly talking 3 or 4 months out to an election. I think they'd be extraordinarily reluctant to order something that dramatic that fast.
David Daley is the former editor-in-chief for Salon and the author of Rat Eft, The True Story Behind the Secret Plan to Steal America's Democracy. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers about Gill v. Whitford, the Wisconsin gerrymandering case headed to the Supreme Court of the United States.
To learn more about the case, you can check out our coverage of the issue, and you can also read Eric Gunn's piece on gerrymandering in this month's Milwaukee Magazine.
Coming up next on the show, astronaut and new children's book author Dr. Kathy Sullivan joins us ahead of her appearances in Milwaukee. That's when Lake Effect returns in a moment on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Adventure is Dr. Kathy Sullivan's motto. The former astronaut has the distinction of being the first U.S. woman to walk in space. That happened in 1984 on her first of three space shuttle missions. Trained as a geologist, she also participated in a number of oceanographic missions that studied the ocean floor.
Sullivan also served from 2014 to 2017 as the director of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, and she's the author of the new children's picture book, To the Stars, the first American woman to walk in space. Sullivan will be in Milwaukee tomorrow giving talks at elementary schools and the Dean's Distinguished Lecture at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee in the evening. We caught up with her at her home and asked her how she tailors her talks to the various groups that she addresses.
You know, with all audiences in one way or another, I try to work in some insights or some reflections on key events, key experiences through which I would trace the line that connected me from a little girl in Southern California to someone wearing a spacesuit outside the spacecraft. And again, with a young audience, you know, you can look around a grade school classroom and kind of spot the kid that's maybe getting in the same kind of trouble you used to get in at that grade, or having the same question in their mind that you used to have there. And it's very fun to try to put a question to the audience or answer one of their questions in a way that opens their eyes to the fact that I wasn't any different than them at that age, and there's nothing that should stop them from dreaming about the boldest goal they might have in their mind at that moment, and then, you know, finding out how close to that goal they can get with good hard work and some good fortune.
So as you were that little girl in Southern California looking up, I think a lot of us did that. Certainly a lot of us who grew up in the 60s where the space race was going on and all kinds of exciting things were happening. Did you have it in your mind even at that early age that I'm going to be one of those people up there?
You know, I did not. I had no real formed thought about what I was going to be when I was growing up. I do think we tend to ask little boys, even to this day, more pointedly, what do you want to be when you grow up? And we tend to ask little girls, what do you like? And so maybe it was just that, but it was not an issue or quest in my mind to come up with a job title. I certainly watched all those guys avidly, and my father was an aerospace engineer, so you know, that added a bit to it, but this was clearly also something coming from within me. You know, it's worth remembering at the same time, back in those early 60s, all the weekly and monthly magazines that would show up in your mailbox back then, Life magazine and Look magazine and National Geographic, almost every one of those would have both some story about these new creatures called astronauts and the amazing things they were doing. And side by side at that time, there were also comparably dramatic stories of the adventures of deep sea explorers, that from Jacques Cousteau to many others, that were opening up the frontiers of scuba diving and exploring the deeps and imagining undersea villages where people would live someday. So I had both of these grand adventures playing out in front of me on a daily and weekly basis, and some of them on television. And what I remember vividly feeling and thinking about was how incredibly cool it was that some people had that kind of adventure in their everyday life. It was the work they did. My dad put on a tie and drove down the road somewhere and came home 8 hours later. That didn't look very adventurous. He was a design engineer. I now realize it was much more stimulating than I could appreciate at the time. But these, you know, visibly grand adventures, seeing the world in a different way, in the case of the oceanographers, traveling to exotic places and exploring the deeps, that really resonated with me. And as far as I took it at those early years, through about high school years, I actually would say, was just sort of holding it as, a kind of an urge or a thought or a hope of, I wonder if my life could have that kind of adventure in it someday. It was clearly a hunger and a real sort of yearning, but through at least the end of high school, nothing was helping me crystallize it into any kind of game plan. It was just a seeking, seeking that kind of adventure.
Yeah, I absolutely get it. I avidly watched the Jacques Cousteau things, too, and, wanted to be up in space when Star Trek happened. I was like, come get me. I will go.
Yeah.
But you got a lot.
I'm there.
Yeah, you got a lot closer. You got a lot closer than I did. But at that time, too, there weren't a lot of women's faces in those pictures. So, you had to extrapolate a little beyond, what you were looking at in those magazines and what was on television, because there weren't a lot of women who were doing that kind of exploration.
Yeah, that's true. And it may be one of the reasons that I've always bristled at the current notion of role modeling, which often is captured as, if I can't see it, I can't be it. Look, no human being would ever have done anything first if that was true, right? If you mm-hmm. always really had to see someone else who looked just like you do it. I understand the kind of extra inspiration that can come from being able to see someone that you can identify with, the sort of confirmation of, oh yeah, someone who is just like me, visibly just like me, can do this. Okay, I get that. But there were not people who looked just like me doing it. And I didn't, again, I would attribute this to my parents' approach to individuality and the way they were raising us. I didn't see this as men or white men are doing this, and therefore there's some implication that I can't. I saw this as people, human beings, expressing and pursuing the urge to explore and understand that is native to every human being. And I never accepted or even thought for a moment that because that person doesn't look like me, I can't take a lesson from them about courage, or I can't take a lesson from them about perseverance, or I can't take a lesson from them about hard work and intelligence. I can look at a man and try to take any lesson I want from him about fatherhood. That's not going to help me a lot. But short of motherhood and fatherhood and a few other things, the qualities of these people that I was watching were about adventurousness and courage and intellect and curiosity. And it absolutely never crossed my mind that none of that was pertinent to me unless it was being done by someone who looked exactly like me.
Which I suppose is part of the adventurousness, too. You just go for it.
Yeah. Yeah, and there was kind of an ethos in our family. I think my parents were very fine parents, but they were spectacular co-discoverers and co-learners. Asking and answering questions together was sort of the favorite sport in the family. If we encountered a problem or saw something interesting, the common way my folks would engage with it was, well, isn't that interesting? Let's see, how could we figure that out? They helped us learn how to use the mental muscles of encountering something new, making some initial sense of it, thinking what that might mean, experimenting, exploring, probing it, and, you know, finding your way forward to some insight or some knowledge or some workable or workable enough solution to a problem, and, you know, not being intimidated about having a question that you didn't yet have an answer to, and not thinking that, you know, if you didn't have a snap answer at the tip of your tongue, you had failed. You know, you build answers, you figure things out. Nobody knows everything at every instant. That's the fun of being a scientist or an engineer, is you're tackling things and answering, building answers to questions no one else has really figured out a way to answer yet.
I was going to say, you're coming up with the actual questions too sometimes, I think, and that's almost as important as the answers.
Always honor a great question even more than you honor an accurate answer.
So I know you probably get asked this all the time, but stepping out into space that first time, what did that feel like?
Well, it's more like swimming than stepping, for one thing, because around the space shuttle when it's in orbit or the International Space Station, you're not moving with your feet. You're moving yourself around really with your hands. You only use your feet if you need to settle somewhere and do some work, push a wrench or something like that. Then you want to be able to anchor your feet in some pedestal that lets you use all the big muscles of your body to deal with the forces of that. But otherwise, you're swimming is the closest thing to it, and scuba diving and underwater training is the primary way you get accustomed to moving in that way. So, you know, you're floating out, not stepping out. And it's a fabulously free feeling of movement. And, of course, quite a coveted and very special experience to be looking at the Earth sliding by beneath you with, you know, no window frame. It's really, you know, you looking at the Earth straight out. And that's pretty spectacular stuff.
Yeah, and then I would think turning and looking out into the blackness of space is also another amazing thing that we don't get to see really from here.
Well, it might be, but two things. Number one, it was always Earth that fascinated me. So any little bits of spare moments I had, I was looking at the Earth, not looking outward. And secondly, you know, at the altitudes that space shuttles and space stations fly, you're above the clouds and the atmosphere, and you're away from all the city lights and things that can make it hard to see the heavens, but you're not really meaningfully closer to any of them. So to me, they never looked all that wildly radically different. The biggest difference to me was in the course of a few days, heck, in the course of a couple of minutes, you could see constellations in the northern hemisphere and the southern hemisphere, which, of course, as an Earthling, you need to spend something between hours and days going from one latitude to another to see that. That was pretty special, to see the Big Dipper and the North Star and the Southern Cross in the span of a couple of minutes is impossible except in a spaceship. But the stars and constellations and even the Milky Way, to me, they felt a lot like ways I had seen them backpacking in some high mountains away from all the lights on a really fabulous clear night. Whereas to see the Earth the way we were seeing it, with the sun rising and setting every 45 minutes, with a continent at your glance outside the window anywhere you looked, seeing the aurora and the air glow layer, and you can see the dynamics of our atmosphere on these remarkable scales, you know, that is such a wildly different way to see the Earth that was way more fascinating to me. But that's over and above the fact that the chance to see the Earth from space with my own eyes was the deepest reason that I even applied to be an astronaut. That's really what the sweet spot was to me. You know, the hardware, the equipment, the operations certainly had a fascination, but why would I want to give up being an oceanographer and apply to be an astronaut? The simple bottom line reason was if by some quirk of fate they accept me, I'll get to actually see the Earth with my own eyes from that vantage point, instead of looking at some other astronaut's pictures or watching movies. The right experience is worth more than just the image.
If we had the technology figured out to get to Mars, would you go?
In a heartbeat. I'm a geologist by original training. How can you not want to see those volcanoes and those spectacular etched plains and Yep, I'd go.
How close do you think we are?
Oh, I don't think we are very close. More for reasons of political will and financial vision than technology. There certainly are some technical hurdles to be overcome, and there's certainly some human health and safety hurdles having to do with radiation and prolonged exposure to zero gravity. But, if a country was serious enough about it and saw any kind of strategic purpose in it, boost a bunch of technologies, really jumpstart a plethora of sciences. I mean, the number of frontiers and science disciplines in which you'd really have to make giant strides forward to pull that off would be numerous. And the benefits that would flow over time to life here on Earth from all of those giant strides would be huge, just as the cascade of benefits that flowed into life here on Earth from the Apollo program and the early space program, that cascade of benefits was huge. No one was targeting, make everyday life better. They were targeting, put people on the moon, bring them back, safe, sound, do it within a decade. And the array of problems they had to tackle, new things they had to learn, new abilities they had to create, was so wide and so rich and so deep that it has spilled over into our life for decades afterwards. And I'm absolutely confident the same would happen again, if not in even greater fashion. If you just mounted as a big, bold push to go to Mars, and then, as I like to say, set the goal and don't blink. It's going to be hard. It will be slow. There will be setbacks. Don't blink. Don't second guess. Don't start and stop. Set it and go. Push through, persevere, accept there will be risk and accept there will be setbacks. But the paybacks, I believe, would be tremendous over a long period of time.
Again, questions we haven't even thought of.
Precisely.
Well, Dr. Kathy Sullivan, we are so looking forward to having you speak here in Milwaukee. I want to thank you so much for taking time to talk with us today.
My pleasure.
Dr. Kathy Sullivan is a scientist, former astronaut, and explorer. The former NOAA administrator will be in Milwaukee tomorrow to speak at area elementary schools and will give the Dean's Distinguished Lecturer at UW-Milwaukee. Her talk there is sold out, but there's more information at WUWM.com.
WUWM is launching a new listener-driven story initiative focused on beat reporting. We'll hear about it next when Lake Effect continues on WUWM.
It's Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. In the last year and a half, our regular Bubbler Talk feature has answered dozens of questions about the Milwaukee area. From last week's segment on a former bathhouse along the Milwaukee River to the former yeast smell that used to greet travelers along I-94.
The questions are all generated by listeners, and now WUWM is expanding the crowdsourced story model to the work of our three beat reporters in a project called Beats Me. Susan Benz covers the environment, Rachel Morello covers education, and Aisha Turner is our race and ethnicity reporter, and they join us, along with Michelle Matanowski, the person behind WUWM's website, who explains more about the project.
It is our way of engaging directly with our audience and our listeners, because you guys are really smart, curious people, and we want to know what questions are on your mind. So Bubbler Talk is built around the question, what do you want to know? Or what questions do you have about the Milwaukee area? And we have gotten such a wide range of really thoughtful to light to really deep subjects through that. So we thought it would be a good idea to expand that whole model of reporting to our beat reporters.
Let me ask a really basic question that I know in my job I get all the time when I meet people out in the world, and I imagine you do too, which is, where do stories start from each of you? The classic, where do you get your ideas? Do you have to dream them all up yourself question? And I'll throw it to any of you. Like, where do the best stories come from already?
I can start.
Yeah.
I'm Aisha. So for me, the best story is to start from just a general sense of curiosity. And it feels like a really obvious answer, but it's actually something that is a bit tricky to implement. It's sometimes a little bit difficult to actually trust your instincts to know, like, because I'm wondering about this, maybe other people are too. And so a lot of the stories that we get are just from things that, like, we're already wondering about or people that we're already curious about. And so I think that for when we're applying that to, like, the Beats Me model, that then expands to our audience and trying to get, like, what do people in the community want to know about and what are they just sort of – what's on their mind?
Susan, Rachel, same for the two of you.
Yeah, I think the interesting thing about being a beat reporter is that a lot of your stories just sort of flow together sometimes. So something that is just a minor detail in one story might become the idea for a next story. And I think that that's kind of how people within each of our disciplines think too. Like, educators who I talk to will say, oh, I noticed you mentioned this really briefly in this story. Have you ever thought about what that means, et cetera, et cetera. So I think the beats themselves really lend themselves to this sort of idea collection model.
Right, one idea begets another.
Right, right.
And
Susan,
I think
Benz?
there are so many ideas, and there's so much curiosity in the environmental world. There's concerns, as in all of our beat areas. And so getting to a point where you feel like you're really not only exploring important issues, interesting issues, and things that pique people's curiosity and our own, it's how can you make that reporting as meaningful as possible?
So in a sense, does some of this validate, you know, when you get a question from a listener that taps into something that you've already wondered about, does this kind of validate your curiosity about the beat in some way?
I think so. And I think also, as Michelle has said, you know, connecting with the listener, we feel like we know some of you. You know, we do hear from people, but hearing what is really on people's mind, either on the light side or the heavy side of a beat area, is really exciting. You feel like you're engaging. You're thinking more about your beat in a different way.
It's also a little bit of a relief because there will be times when I'll be wondering about something and I'll think, oh, that's kind of obvious. I should already know. I think an example for that from you would be the March on Milwaukee. I'm sort of thinking that, like, everybody kind of knows about these open housing marches already, but then it turns out that it's actually not something that people are thinking about a lot and talking about a lot. And so when you hear the community kind of ask about these, like, specific questions or events, you're sort of saying, like, oh, okay, it's okay that I'm not really familiar with this yet, and we can all kind of do this together and learn together.
Rachel Morello, would you think that there are also topics out there, for as much as you do on education every day, do you think there are topics out there that are just completely not on your radar that this might expose you to?
Oh, yeah, totally. I think we all live in our own neighborhoods. We all sit at our own desks. We all have our own things that we do during the day. So there's just things that we're not exposed to. Or, like, in my case, I went to school A and school B, but not C and D. So there are just things that there's no way you would know about them unless somebody involved brought it up to you and made you aware of it.
Give us the nuts and bolts. How does this work? How are we soliciting questions?
Well, the easiest way is to go to our website. You can go to wuwm.com/beatsme, and that'll kind of give you a primer on each of our beat reporters and the questions they're hoping to collect. And then they each have their own, like, hub page on our website that shows all the reporting that they've done. And it also involves a space where you can submit your question. Another component to this, in wanting to have a better sense of the kind of questions that exist in our community, is for us to go out in our community so that we're not just gathering questions from the people who are already know us and listen to public radio, but so that we're reaching people who don't know that public radio exists and we're here to tell their stories and answer their questions.
I think it's less about finding people that don't know that public radio exists, but, like, really trying to find people that don't necessarily think that public radio is for them. I think especially when talking about race and ethnicity, I want to be sure that I'm not just talking about race to a predominantly white audience. I want to make sure that I'm answering questions that represent the diversity that exists in Milwaukee.
I want to hear from parents and kids. As an education reporter, I get a lot of, like, figureheads, and those people are important and have obviously really interesting things to say, but kids are in schools every day, parents are picking them up every day, teachers are the ones making the learning happen every day. So I'd like to hear from those people a little bit more. If you're out there, submit a question.
And I think in the environmental area, I think some people just hear environment and think, you know, heaviness. Yeah. And I think that it can be both a celebration of what people are concerned and what they means most to them in their environment, and something they've just always wondered about and thought, you know, I'm just going to ask this.
Well, listen, Michelle, Aisha, Susan, Rachel, thanks to all of you. And we'll make sure people can find their way over to WWM.com.
Thanks, Mitch.
Thanks, Mitch.
Thank you.
Aisha Turner covers race and ethnicity, Rachel Morello covers education, and Susan Bentz is our environmental reporter. Michelle Matternowski manages the WUWM website. You can submit questions through our Beats Me initiative at WUWM.com.
One last break, and then cellist Robert Cohen joins us for On That Note. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Mitch Tine.
And I'm Bonnie North. Cellist and Lake Effect contributor Robert Cohen joins us now for this month's On That Note segment. It's an ongoing conversation we have about the life of a touring classical musician. Today, we discover that Robert has made a large technological leap.
I am now using an iPad on a special stand to read my music. And that has come about very slowly, I have to say. I've been watching Miguel using one for the last, I suppose, couple of years. So he has all of his music scanned so that he can see it on the screen in front of him. And then he has a pedal which he uses to turn the pages.
Oh, how fun.
Yes. Well, I was, you know, very reluctant to take up the idea because I suppose it's a bit like people reading books and then switching to a Kindle or something like that. You know, the arguments are always about, oh, yeah, but you don't get the feel of the book and you only see one page at a time. Whereas, I mean, you can see two pages when you read a book, don't you? And that's exactly the same with music. You see the way it's printed, you see two pages in front of you. So while you're reading the left-hand page, you're kind of aware of where you are in the music visually because there's so much of it in front of you. Whereas the tablet view is only one page at a time because the tablets are just not big enough to do more than one page. And I was kind of thinking, well, do I want to feel limited by not being able to see ahead of myself that much? And do I want to be pressing a pedal to turn the pages? Because, you know, I'm very particular about the way I sit when I play. We've probably talked about this. And, you know, the position of my feet. And do I want to alter that even for a moment while I turn the page? And so I've been kind of talking about it with him. And he's been saying, oh, you must try it. So go on, try it. And I've just the idea of it, I suppose, because I've spent my life reading printed music, like most musicians.
And so what made you finally say, okay, I'll try it?
Well, I was actually playing a concert as a guest of the Belcher Quartet in Europe. We had a concert in Warsaw. That was the Schubert Quintet, so the four of them plus me. And they were all using iPads. And I felt very, I felt very much out on a limb, especially when we got onto the platform to rehearse before the concert. And my music was blowing. The pages were blowing because somehow the air conditioning or something in the hall was such that, you know, I was playing and suddenly my pages were turning backwards and forwards and they were looking at me and just saying, iPad, iPad, you know, and I was thinking, oh, come on, this is getting ridiculous now. You know, there's too many excuses for, I could make for not doing it, but you know, I've really, really got to try it. So that's what I did. I just decided to take the plunge. There are a lot of other musicians that are doing it too, but we find it so difficult to move because you have just a few things that we're clinging on to, you know, from our entire lives reading music.
So first impressions, the first time you sat down with it in a rehearsal to try to use the electronic notebook to play a piece, was it awkward? Was it like relearning how to play in a way?
No, it was absolutely fantastic.
So you'd been resisting for nothing.
Yeah, you know what? The first thing you notice is it's so clear. You don't have to worry about whether there's good lighting on your music because it is just amazingly clear. You know, it's backlit. You've got really good contrast. You just don't have to think whether there is good light on your music and worry about it. And, you know, as eyesight gets slightly worse as we get older, I have noticed that, you know, I'm reliant on good light. And there are so many occasions on stage even where the light isn't that great. Either it's designed for like theatre productions and not specifically for reading music. Or, you know, you might be somewhere like a church or some sort of centre, conference centre or something, where there just isn't specific lighting that's really good for reading music on the stage. And so this thing, it just is perfect all the time. So that's the first thing you notice. And that really makes you feel very comfortable. And another thing I noticed, which I find unexpected for me, was that when you're playing chamber music, in other words, you know, with various other people, when you have printed music in front of you, especially when you have to organize it so there are, for instance, three pages on the stand in a row because of difficult page turns, you find you're looking quite a long way to your left-hand side for the left-hand page and quite a long way to the right for the right-hand page. Now, if you're also kind of looking at your fellow musicians, you know, as you play and looking up for a certain moments and catching their eye and just looking to them for some indication of exactly where they're going to play, with that page spread from left to right, you find you're looking quite a long way away from who you might want to be watching. Whereas the tablet, it's only one page all the time, and you can set it to a position where you can most easily glance up or notice what else is going on and then glance back to the music. So from that point of view, I suddenly thought, you know, this is really good. It's really helping an ease of communication. And then beyond that, another thing that I think is really good, especially for cellists, I have to say this, that normally the music stand is kind of in front of us, especially when you're playing a string quartet. The music is in front of you and it's at a height that becomes a kind of barrier to the sound flowing from the cello to the audience, and also a sense of feeling of a barrier visually. Whereas the other instruments, the violins and violas, they have the same height music, but they're holding their instruments obviously up under their chins. So their sound is unaffected by a barrier at all. So the iPad or whatever you use is such a smaller bit of barrier. It's just an A4 size and you can position it nicely so that in fact it's much less of a sound barrier than a music stand would be with the music on it. And I think that's got to be an advantage as well.
Well, then this makes me want to ask, though, about making notes in the margins, because I know most musicians will write little notes to yourself, or there'll be an accent. There'll be some kind of pencil mark somewhere.
Yeah.
And so how do you do that? Do you have a little stylus that allows you to make notes?
You do. Well, you know, the touch screen computers, and this is what these tablets are doing now. We have a special pen that you can use, and there's special software specifically for this kind of situation. So I have a score reading software that allows me to write, you know, immediately, or write it as though it's a piece of paper, and I get to choose the colors. I can use the keyboard to make text. I can have thick brushes or thin brushes, and I can erase almost automatically with a kind of eraser, or I can white out sections that I want. And then you can put symbols in that are musical symbols rather than draw them yourself. You've got the kind of a palette of those things. So it's incredibly simple. And you can use it like a piece of paper, but I'm saving myself a fortune on erasers and
and printing costs.
Yeah, I mean, it's just something we've lived with. And strangely enough, we've just been, well, I've been reluctant to make a change. And I know, even just the other day, I was talking to a musician. He said, yeah, but what happens if it fails? What happens if this doesn't happen? You know, the batteries go, or, you know, all these questions. And my answer to him was really, well, I've not experienced it. I've been sitting next to Miguel for a couple of years using that. He's never had a problem. The people I talk to who are using it regularly just say it works. So let's not be too frightened about it, you know.
Well, I do have to ask, Robert, you are backing up your tablet, right?
Okay, yes, Bonnie, I'm doing everything I can. And believe me, I'm in these early stages. My battery is charged to the maximum, to the very moment before I go on the stage. I'm not taking any chances.
Well, just make sure you get all of, as you keep adding music to it, that you back it up onto your computer so that if the iPad ever does crash, you can pull it back.
Yes. Yeah, especially when you have everything on it. And that's another thing. See, I'm carrying around this one little thing now, and it has, you know, so many pieces of music which would normally be filling out my briefcase and weighing an absolute ton.
I was gonna say,
as I travel.
Your back must be happier.
Well, I'm always happy about my back being happier, that's for sure, especially carrying a cello around, as you know.
Right. You don't need to add another 20 pounds of music. Well, Robert, it is so nice to welcome you to the 21st century.
Finally.
Yeah.
I've got a good balance here, haven't I, with a cello from 1723 and music from 2000 and what are we now?
17.
Thank you.
Yes. That's pretty good. Well, Robert, it is great to hear your voice. When are you in Milwaukee next?
Very soon, actually. Just this week, I'll be arriving just as everybody hears this.
Well, we're looking forward to hearing you play. We're looking forward to seeing the tablet. And thanks so much for joining us today.
Pleasure. Nice to talk to you, Bonnie.
Cellist Robert Cohen is a regular Lake Effect contributor. The Fine Arts Quartet will perform this Sunday at the Zelazo Center. There's more information at WUWM.com. And that is all for today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Do be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another Lake Effect. It's right here on Listener Supported, 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Stay tuned. Fresh Air is next.